project for a government looking at how do you really, in a verifiable manner, ensure that a uranium enrichment program in North Korea is dismantled. Obviously, it wasn't of great use. It was done prior to the leak date attempt, and which, as you all know, fell apart. Hope springs eternal, and things do look better now. And what I'd like to do is go through kind of a more general view on denuclearization, motivate some of it, and then talk about some of the issues. And let me, before I start this, is everyone familiar with nuclear terms? If I say gas centrifuge, everyone knows what that is, at least in a vague general way. If not, don't hesitate to just ask what it is. I mean, Houston and I are both, I'm a physicist, he's an engineer. He's also, for decades, worked in the gas centrifuge industry in the United States. So he's very, very technically sophisticated and probably even more prone than me to use acronyms and terms that are difficult to understand. But we do want you to understand this, and certainly we've designed the talk so that it's at a more policy relevant level. So
since I'm a professor, expect a quiz at the end.
One thing, we brought books from another project that we do. It's called the Penalty Peril Index. We did a project for about over a year and a half trying to evaluate national export control, strategic export control systems. And our last workshop was we presented the results of that. And we brought some of the books if you're interested in export controls. I mean, it's a deadly boring subject, but vitally important. And we found that nobody had ever evaluated the world's export control regimes on a national basis. So this book summarizes our results. And we have enough to hand them out freely for nothing. They're also available on our website and other ebook websites. But anyway, let me get back to the denuclearization. I prepared a set of slides, which I believe all of you have been emailed, I don't know, or will be soon. In North Korea, I've gotten into a bad habit of, instead of writing reports, writing presentations. And I'm not going to cover the presentation very precisely at all, but if you are interested in using it as background information, it's available and discusses denuclearization much greater detail than I'll go into. So I'm going to mostly skip over the slides with a lot of words or summarize them quickly. So I would recommend not trying to read them unless you're a very fast reader. But they are, if you have an iPhone or other smartphone, I think you may have them in your email box by now. But the first thing is, denuclearization is a vague concept if you've been involved in verification or safeguards. I think that baseline for it is I would use a national or a UN Security Council resolution to really define it. And here's one from 2016, it's the third bullet, that it's really about North Korea banning all nuclear weapons and existing nuclear programs in a complete, verifiable, and irreversible manner, and immediately cease all related activities. So it's an incredibly broad statement. But I think from a point of view of studying this subject, that's the start. It isn't about freezing Yongbyon and then negotiating something after that. It really is meant to be a fairly substantial initial commitment. Again, who knows what is achievable, but I think to study it does require that definition. It's been a complicated couple of months. The North Korea has extensive nuclear programs, and these are just terms of art that have developed in the negotiations in time. Plutonium program, which is really about plutonium and associated production reactors, or reactor right now, anaerobic processing plant to separate the plutonium. The uranium enrichment program, which I'll talk about more, is a known site. We think there's another site that's North Korea has to admit to. There's now a thermonuclear materials program with the production or the separate or the enrichment of lithium-6. Obviously, they have nuclear weapons. We see nuclear weapons as the warhead. I didn't state it here very precisely, but it's the warhead and the delivery system. We don't think you could separate those two things from each other in a productive manner. And so if you're going to do denuclearization, you have to look at both. Nuclear weaponization, I use in a very general sense, all the processes, technologies, capabilities that go into designing, developing, testing, making, and maintaining the nuclear weapon itself. In North Korea, you have to worry about proliferation. You can't escape that because of their history. And Houston will talk more about that. And then you can't really escape that they run pretty sophisticated illicit procurement schemes for their nuclear program, their missile program, military programs, and that they heavily depend on those imports. And I won't have time to talk about it today, but we track as much as we can, but the work we do in Europe, we're able to track it pretty well, their procurements for their nuclear program. And it's a challenge to get it under control. One part that's often forgotten in this is that the goal of this ultimately is to bring North Korea into compliance with the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And that's the bottom line. And so ultimately, the International Atomic Energy Agency has to be involved. North Korea has to ideally accept the additional protocol and be able to allow, willing to allow inspectors into the country and to inspect more than Yongbyon. Let me summarize this. I mean, I just give some theoretical framework on denuclearization, and this is actually from, we did track two events or one and a half events with the North Koreans in the 2000s, where we spent several years with them, a couple times a year, going through what does it mean to verifiably denuclearize your nuclear program. And so it was essentially with foreign ministry officials. And really the steps are pretty straightforward, but I just want you to keep them in mind that you have to know what it is you're going to say or dismantle. You have to be able to freeze it. The term of art now is developed in the six-party talks is disable, so it's harder to restart than just flipping a switch. If it's a facility, you have to present declarations. You then have to verify all that. And then in step two, you want to start dismantling all these items, nuclear weapons, facilities, equipment. You have to deal with plutonium, separated plutonium with the highly enriched uranium. New desire to deal with the thermonuclear materials. How much of that have they made? And then this last phase three should be step three, they come into compliance with the NPT, which is a whole nother set of challenges that are very difficult to work with given the history between the International Atomic Energy Agency and North Korea. Bad blood that goes back into the early 1990s and has not been reconciled to this day. And throughout that process, you have to have a benefits. Now, the timing on this is really up to North Korea. I mean, you can compress all these into a very short period of time if you wanted to. The last step may be to develop confidence, because the idea there is you have to have confidence that there aren't undisclosed or undeclared nuclear facilities and materials. And that just takes time, because you can't prove a negative, so you just keep at it, trying to figure it out, looking for contradictions, looking for openness and building confidence over time. So that actually is hard to compress. In the practical world, I mean, if you look at the six-party talks, you have to admit, it hasn't never really went that well. And it was North Korea, you actually have to enter something else, at least in our analysis, that you have to have North Korea tell you what they have. And I'll show some pictures, images. We really don't know much about their nuclear program from a verification point of view. I kind of delude ourselves thinking because we in 38 North publish a lot of photos of Yongbyon at a few facilities at Yongbyon at the test site that somehow we actually know what's going on there. And I would argue we don't at all, that it really is a bit of a black box. And so in this kind of more fine-parsed view is there really has to be an introduction to their program and then visits, preferably from my point of view, by U.S. officials of this complex that's out there. And then it goes into these, you know, the other disabling, producing the declaration, verifying. And in the last round of the six-party talks back in 2008, on just the plutonium, they were in phase, they got through phase two, and it fell apart in the first part of phase three to verify the declaration. So, and that's just plutonium. The uranium program was set aside, the weaponization program was sort of off limits. And let me quickly show you some sites in North Korea. This is an overhead image of Yongbyon, and you can see in the northern part there's the 5 megawatt reactor, as it's called. It's a North Korean term. It's about a 20 megawatt thermal reactor, gas cooled, graphite moderated, makes a little bit of plutonium every year. There's in the middle, a plutonium separation plant called the Radiochemical Laboratory by North Korea. Dates to a time when they wanted to minimize the perception of its size. Down in the south is a fuel fabrication complex, and there's the main centrifuge building at Yongbyon is there. There's a close-up of the 5 megawatt electric reactor, and then adjacent to it is a light water reactor they're building that is either pre-operational or will soon operate. Here's the radiochemical laboratory or plutonium separation area. It's a fairly complex area, but most of it has to do with waste processing. And the canyon is up in the top right, where they would actually separate the plutonium. There's, you see the blue roof building for the centrifuge plant, which, as far as I know, no one figured out that was a centrifuge plant before North Korea announced. One facility that is new is what we call a possible isotope separation facility. We don't think it's a plutonium separation plant. We had a retired expert from Savannah River do the analysis of the imagery as it was being built and feeling. And then we checked with at least one other government, not the U.S. government, but another one, and the sense that it's probably more to do with separating isotopes, given its kind of military-first attitude. We think it's probably more related to tritium separation than moly-99 separation from which, for those of you know, is a medical isotope. The tritium would be produced in a little 5 megawatt reactor or a Soviet supplied research reactor, very small quantities. But nonetheless, we think this building needs to be looked at more carefully. Let me go outside of Yongbyon. I mean, our assessment, which we got in conjunction with another government, is that half the nuclear sites are outside of Yongbyon. And that I think increasingly there's an older, perhaps larger gas centrifuge plant. I mean, certainly there's well-known uranium mines and mills. There's got to be uranium hexafluoride production someplace. Mentioned centrifuges. There's got to be a site to make lithium-6, which we think is near Hong Kong, and some of this is driven by procurement. We have information that North Korea was buying goods that are distinctive to enriching lithium-6. The contract information, the order information, says it's for this site, this Hongnam Chemical Complex. We never could cite the place. We couldn't find the place in that complex. But the ordering information strongly indicates that it's for that place. And it makes sense to put it there. And then, of course, where do they make nuclear weapons? And where do they integrate them with delivery systems? Where do they store them? I mean, all these are unknown. There's, of course, the Hongjongri underground test site, which is great news that it's going to be dismantled. A little disappointing that they didn't invite U.S. monitoring, as far as I know, or monitoring by the International Atomic Energy Agency. It's mostly a press event, and you have to hope that it's not like the destruction of the cooling tower in 2008 on the 5-megawatt electric reactor. We're hoping that's not the high watermark of this effort. It is kind of a visible destruction of a test site. And I would say it isn't. The test site is, from my point of view, it's still usable. The tunnel complex in that mountain may have been destroyed by the last test, but there's other mountains. And there's other sites probably that North Korea could build if it wanted to continue testing. So I think people in 2007 or so said that the 5-megawatt reactor was a piece of junk, and that's why North Korea shut it down. But we happen to know now, looking back, that North Korea is quite competent at running junk, and that reactor was restarted and has made plutonium again. Here's the uranium mine. This one is a little tougher, but based on defector information, based on collaboration with people in other governments, we came to view that this was an underground site where North Korea is suspected to have run initial R&D on centrifuges. So again, it could be wrong. That you felt that the information was good enough to do a study on it and point it out. And it would a facility that we think was shut down a while ago and that was involved in probably in the 1990s when they really were first getting going, late 90s, getting going on getting the assistance from the Pakistani centrifuge program, starting to receive P1 and what are called P1 and P2 centrifuges. We have the dates of when those centrifuges were sent based on the investigations of the Khan network. And so we think this could be where they set up the shop. Skip this. Well, on this example of the proliferation, maybe I won't skip it. The North Korea, we mostly watch what they try to buy. For their nuclear program, but periodically they try to sell, and we learned of a brochure, color brochure that was found in China, where they were advertising the sale of nuclear-grade graphite, which is a controlled item, a controlled dual-use good. And in the brochure, it talks about how it's useful as a moderator, which is what it was developed for originally, was to be a moderator in a reactor. It's used in 5-megawatt electric reactor. Some suspect maybe the light water reactor is a graphite moderated water-cooled reactor. It's a minority view, but still, North Korea has a reason to have nuclear-grade graphite. And also, the brochure talks about that it's good to make isotopes. Again, kind of reinforcing this idea that if you're interested in nuclear things, this is something that we're willing to sell you. And so, we found this site that we think is where they have built this nuclear-grade graphite plant. And it's run by the Atomic Energy Organization, or Atomic Establishment, is what our understanding is. So again, I'm not sure we want this inspected, but we want North Korea not to be selling these goods overseas, and particularly we don't frankly trust North Korea's export control system. They didn't do well in our peddling peril index. So we also think that in the negotiations, this has to be brought in, the whole idea of what North Korea could proliferate in a very broad sense that would pick up dual-use goods. There's a whole set of slides on the question of a earlier centrifuge plant. I'm going to just summarize it for sake of time. The initial U.S. reporting, unclassified reporting, is North Korea's building a centrifuge plant starting in the early 2000s. I mean, a plant to make significant amounts of weapon-grade uranium. And that reporting was done by George Tenet, who was the public part before Congress. And I was a skeptic. It was happening in the fall of 2002. We were challenging the aluminum tube story of other Bush administration reporting on Iraq's nuclear weapons program. And I must confess, we were pretty harsh on this information on North Korea because the way it was formulated. And I remained a skeptic for many years. But as we started, my institute started digging deeper into the procurement of North Korea, there were certain things started to emerge. And one of which is, let me just find a slide. It is a chronology of detected procurements related to gas centrifuges. And that what you see is there's peaks in the purchasing of goods for a centrifuge program. And you see a huge peak in the early 2000s for, I don't know, it varies by, and in which government you talk to, or which data you look at. And some of this has been threshed out publicly pretty thoroughly, and also in criminal prosecutions. But you get a peak of 8,000 to 12,000, and these are again P2 type centrifuges, which is about this tall. And it is a German design that Pakistan stole and then eventually spread to North Korea. You also start seeing peaks like in 2008, sufficient for 2,000 centrifuges. You have some additional ones later. And these later ones correspond to known events. The 2008 can be correlated with the plan revealed at Yongbyon in 2010. That plant floor space was doubled. A couple years later, you see a procurement at the end of 2010 for several hundred centrifuges, and then you can see some later for smaller amounts. So where did all those the procurements from the early 2000s go to? I mean, it's really hard to say that they just all broke. I mean, a lot could have broken, but it leads to a conclusion that there must be another plant someplace, and that it would be nice if North Korea would straighten this out. I mean, it would be nice, we'll volunteer, take this to the plant, and they can reveal it as a sign of tremendous transparency. Certainly, one has to worry that if they don't reveal it, that there's going to be at least two governments that I know of, they're going to be very troubled about the incompleteness of the declaration. It's possible. And we, in our estimates of fissile material, particularly weapon-grade uranium, we still are at the point where we assume they have one Yongbyon, or we assume they have two. This older one and then a newer one. And in my experience with centrifuge plants of the Pakistani type is thousands of centrifuges really can't break, and in fact do. And so you may find a huge amount and only getting several thousand to actually run in a consistent way during the first many years of the program. And I know I was last in Pyongyang in 2011 and had a discussion with, asked the question of, he's one of the heads of the Nuclear Weapons Institute, I forget his name, Lee, spelled R-I. I forget his name, but he said that they were having trouble at the enrichment plant. I mean, the engineers tend to be straightforward within reason. Obviously, it's a very controlled setting, but he wasn't trying to say this thing runs really well. but nonetheless, it could be the 2010 plant was a second one and does run better than the first one. So one could make a legitimate argument that this isn't, the first one isn't running 12,000 centrifuges, or even necessarily with 6,000. But still, the evidence is so strong that it exists that I think it has to be taken into account. Let me just give some numbers. I'm not sure how much they mean. I mean, these are estimates we had through 2017 of how much plutonium and weapon-grade uranium and nuclear weapons they could have. And again, it's a crude estimate. And 30 kilograms of separated plutonium. There's more in the sense that it's in the reactor core or in discharge fuel. Several kilograms in addition that we don't think has been separated yet. I mean, the weapon-grade uranium estimates, depending on the one or two, are as 230 to 760 kilograms. And then we have a very crude estimate of 14 to 33 nuclear weapons. And so, again, these are not meant to be precise. I mean, we'd like to make them precise. But there's tremendous uncertainties in doing these numbers. And I think in a verification point of view, it sort of shows the problems that are going to develop in the denuclearization process. That these numbers have to be given by North Korea, and then they have to be verified. And I'll come back to that, but it's not easy by any means. One thing, if I just look at the upper bound and look at that a little more detailed. If you assume two plants, not anywhere near 12,000 centrifuges in the older one, you get a range. This is just how we do the estimate. You get a distribution of values. And this has been converted into number of nuclear weapons, but it's really being driven by the enrichment side of this. But you get a range where the median is around 33 weapons and the 5th and 95th percentile is 26 to 44. So if they do have this other plant, they have potentially a great number of nuclear weapons. And how many needs to be declared and a verification effort launched to figure out is that number accurate? Let me go dive into the verification issue. And here's just what I presented earlier, the various programs. I want to say briefly that there's been a tremendous amount of work on verified denuclearization. Denuclearization should, by definition, include verification, but I'm just trying to emphasize it. I mean, because of my political background, I have a hard time with the CVID. You know, I know. Probably should be more comfortable, but it was politically controversial back in the 80s. But it's really the point, complete, verified, irreversible dismantlement. I mean, that really is the point. And it was not achieved in the six-party talks. But a lot of studying was done, and a lot of understanding was developed about what it would take. Plus, other examples got developed much more. We had a few copies of this book we did on South Africa's nuclear weapons program. It's kind of it's deliberately fairly technical. It discusses their program, and I was involved in working with the African National Congress in the early 90s and on nuclear policy, and ended up meeting a lot of the weaponeers and touring their sites and having sort of ongoing relations with them over the subsequent decade or so. And finally put it all in a book about what they did and particularly how they dismantled. So it's probably the only real life example of a verified dismantlement of a nuclear weapons program, albeit it's not perfect because they dismantled and then they verified, which creates problems. And it's in the North Korea case, you want to dismantle and verify in parallel. And if you go back to the test site, we'll bring that up again. What you really want to do there, and it's absolutely necessary to do, is drill back into the locations of the explosion and take samples to see how much plutonium and weapon-grade uranium and perhaps thermonuclear materials were actually used in each one of the tests. And in the previous declaration by North Korea on plutonium, they said that the 2006 test had used 2 kilograms of plutonium. But they wouldn't allow the United States to verify that claim. And that was one of the unresolved controversies from back in the late 2000s. In the slides, I talk a little bit about the components of the deal. We come to this one. There were a whole bunch of issues that turned out to be controversial, and they're unfortunately, they haven't been resolved. And one of these people that you're looking for is North Korea really changing on these kinds of very concrete issues. Provision of documents, allowing interviews with people in the program. I think they will. And certainly when I and others have gone to Pyongyang or Yongbyon and met with the engineers, they're certainly open to talking, but will they be allowed? Will declarations be adequate? Will access be enough? How do you define the sites, the undeclared sites that are eligible for visits or inspections? Who even does the verification? Is it the U.S.? Is it the International Atomic Energy Agency? That'll have to be settled. In the six-party talks, the sampling issue is really what sunk the deal. And where North Korea allowed sampling limited, it was to get at the issue of how much plutonium was made in the 5-megawatt reactor, and was any plutonium made in the little Soviet supply reactor. The IAEA had information that some had been. But this marvelous technique was developed to take samples of the graphite in the 5-megawatt reactor and come up with an estimate of total plutonium production. And since the graphite held the history of, the facility, North Korea agreed and then reneged a couple weeks later on that. There was also a tendency back then to negotiate the verification arrangements piecemeal. From a practical point of view, you'd like all those arrangements put together beforehand, before you start the actual work, before there's a declaration, and certainly before you start the process. But the way that negotiation worked, and a lot of it was just because of the resistance in North Korea, the U.S. was forced into a piecemeal set of negotiations, and very unsatisfying. If this is about denuclearization, it's the second to last bullet. If you're going to disable, you shut them down, disable, why not destroy? Prior, in the earlier negotiations, it was store. Well, we know what happened. They took them out of storage and restarted several of these facilities, sometimes faster than we thought they could. So again, it's something to look for. And then also, should thermonuclear materials be included in this? I heard in a meeting with the government, the European government, they think it should be. If they can, they're making lithium-6, perhaps tritium, they're saying they're building thermonuclear weapons. So they've got to be at least having lithium-6 and deuterium. Probably they'd want tritium to help them get the process going. And so should that be part of the denuclearization? Now, I think this is really probably the rub of the whole thing. I don't know if I'm a hardliner on this. I mean, in some way we study this and try to make sense out of it. But again, I had experience in understanding Iraq's nuclear weapons program in the 90s. Had a lot of lying done to me. Often I believe it and find out I've been lied to. And some are bold-faced lies. So, I mean, these programs are not honest. I mean, this isn't like the United States and the Soviet Union. These are programs developed in secret. A lot of the purpose of the program, or the strategy of the program, is to be secret and use that to their advantage. And so you have to look for a commitment and a demonstration that they mean to denuclearize. And I've seen it happen. In South Africa, President de Klerk made a decision to get rid of nuclear weapons and created an order, a document that ordered the dismantlement of the program. I mean, will North Korea do that? In Iraq, after the defection of Saddam Hussein's son-in-law, they decided to come clean on the nuclear weapons program. And they did. And things that were completely opaque, particularly I worked a lot on procurement, particularly in Germany for their gas centrifuge program, things that, you know, we've been investigations, knew a lot, but it was like a flood of information once they decided they were going to review everything. And it led to unraveling the entire procurement network, unraveling what they did in the nuclear weapons program. And the declaration, which had the unfortunate name of the full, final, and complete declaration, and had many, many versions, but it grew from like this thick to like this thick. And it was just filled with a great deal of technical information. And you could just see the transformation in the cooperation, in the information, answering questions. And so I think you know it when you see it. And it's never been seen in North Korea. And will it be? And I think that'll be one of the tests of this effort, is whether North Korea's really turned the corner. Certainly the second bullet is this corollary of the first. I mean, will there be full cooperation? And that's what you expect. And it's not just, you know, in the case of Iran, people have gotten used to that there isn't full cooperation, and that's somehow the norm. In non-proliferation, that isn't the norm at all. Go ask Japan, Germany, you know, examples of South Africa, Ukraine. I mean, just go around the world. And the norm is cooperation and transparency. North Korea is also going to have to understand that sanctions this round, according to the administration officials, aren't coming off just because they enter serious negotiations. That's going to be, we'll see, that's a tough one for them. And then I think it does need a commitment, a demonstrated commitment. I mean, in the South Korean media over the weekend, there was some discussion that the United States has asked North Korea to send out 5 nuclear weapons to France right away. I have no idea if that's true or not, but that would be a concrete commitment to plan to be nuclear. I'm not sure I would have thought of doing that, but, you know, if North Korea is serious, I hope they consider it. Typically, you expect the nuclear weapons to be dismantled in country. And also another twist in all this in nonproliferation compared to U.S.-Soviet is you, of course, have full access to the nuclear weapons design information. I mean, that's just the norm for the inspectors. It's a little shocking, perhaps, but the IA has people from weapons states. Some of the rules get bent a little. International rules on classification aren't like what they are in the United States. I've seen plenty of nuclear weapons design information in South Africa or in Iraq. But you can't do the job without it. It's just not possible because you're trying to understand how much plutonium and highly enriched uranium is in these weapons, down to the level that you need to know that you understand the total amount produced by that country to less than one weapon. So in South Africa, it was a little easier because it was about 55 kilograms per weapon. They got it down to where they felt the discrepancy between the declaration, and this is they, in this case, was the IAEA, the discrepancy between the declaration by South Africa and their recreation of that amount was less than 5 kilograms. So they felt they had really kind of nailed it through a couple different approaches. and felt that they could say with certainty that North, that South Africa was not hiding any nuclear weapons. Now, they used gun-type device, uses a lot more highly enriched uranium, the weapons of uranium. The North Koreans used an implosion device where they said 2 kilograms is what was used in the 2006 test. So that alone is going to mean that the verification on the amounts of material produced is going to have to be pretty rigorous. You know, my hope is that in what use of weapon-grade uranium, they're more around 20 kilograms if they build weapons out of weapon-grade uranium. Because the plutonium is easier to do than the weapon-grade uranium. So, but it is, you can't do it without knowing intimate information about the weapon. Yeah, and I guess this is more on policy, but it's also an approach. U.S. did try an incremental piece-by-piece approach. I mean, and maybe some in the room know some of the fighting that happened in the summer and fall of 2008 over this. I mean, I was on the side that wanted to go easier on North Korea. I think over time, I've shifted because it didn't work and it fell apart. And I think we need an approach now that where you do settle the verification arrangements up front, across the board, for the plutonium, enriched uranium, weaponization, and the nuclear arsenal itself. And doing it piecemeal is really almost an invitation for failure, because it's going to be, things are going to get complicated. I mean, I doubt if North Korea, even if it agrees to sort of agreeing to give up these things, is going to have an easy time telling their militaries, you know, let these guys from the United States in. And then the U.S., unless it's hard, I'm sure has a whole list of suspect sites. And we have a list of suspect sites. I was thinking of showing some of them today. One's just this coordinate brings you to the top of a mountain, and on the side of the mountain there are tunnel entrances, and it's tagged related to nuclear weapons. And what does that mean? And it may be that that's where they keep their secret tanks, you know, and others are saying, well, you may have nuclear weapons hidden there. So, I mean, there's going to be, even if it goes well, there's going to be tremendous challenges to try to make this thing work. But I think it's much worse if you don't arrange the verification rules up front. And it's not unprecedented. I mean, if you look at how the International Atomic Energy Agency does safeguards, there's a safeguards agreement. You know, there's the additional protocol. These are established agreements with set rules. And again, there's be a lot of problems in the implementation, but you start with a set of rules. And that also feeds into what should be declared. North Korea needs to know what it needs to declare about its programs so that the verification can be done efficiently. And then I think the last one I said, I mean, this is, if it's not the entire program, then I wonder why we bother. I mean, one of the reasons we focused on this other enrichment plant is because we know North Korea is making nuclear weapons now. So how many, in a sense, would it make from its activities at Yongbyon? How many does it make from outside of Yongbyon? And our crude estimates is that annually it's making from Yongbyon about 3 weapons a year, and outside 2 weapons a year. So if you just piecemeal pick off Yongbyon or plutonium, North Korea's, and you catch the centrifuge plant. For the leap day deal, they agreed they would shut down that centrifuge plant. They would turn off the centrifuges. That may come up again, but I was in a meeting where they said, we will shut down the P2 centrifuges. The nuclear establishment accepted it, hated it, but all the 65 parties agreed on this, and they would shut it down. But they wouldn't talk about it any other centrifuge. So we want to go through this again, one part shut down, another part can still be making weapon-grade uranium, but then feeds into nuclear weapons. So I think, again, it has to be a holistic approach. Another thing is, and this is more in the weeds, but you know, how do you do that? How do you account for the material? And there's a traditional way to do it through a material balance. If that makes any sense, you're just looking at sort of uranium being mined, being used, transformed, and you just, it's like a bookkeeping operation. It's not very precise often, particularly in a nuclear weapons program where the priority isn't counting, but getting your nuclear weapons built. And it's often using facilities that don't function that well because they're the first ones you've ever built. So it's difficult. And so you do have to supplement it with other things. You can use procurement information. You can use methods developed in South Africa to study how much separative work or what was the enrichment output of the plant, the enriched uranium. You know, if they have daily or weekly operating logs, that could help you reconstruct the history of production of enriched uranium at the plant. But you'll have to work to put all these together. But I don't think one technique will work. Are there any questions, media questions? Houston's going to speak and then we'll open it up. There's a lot more in these slides. I gave an example. This is from a study we did several years ago. We'll brought up today a little bit on looking more in the weeds of go through these phases. If you're going to take apart verifiably a gas centrifuge program. And we presented this to the North Koreans. I mean, it was kind of amusing. It was one of the first things we presented to them. And of course, they had to give a speech how they had no such centrifuge program. But they were willing to listen and went through this. Let me show you one thing at the end. On verified nuclear dismantlement, just so people see that, I don't know if you can read this. Is this readable back there? Maybe not. Yeah, maybe it's not going to work. But let me just say what it is. South Africa, it got the order to dismantle. Well, the weaponeers then had to turn to the challenge, okay, you're dismantling. What do you keep? What should go away? They developed the concept of its proliferation. Sensitive, it should be destroyed. So the weapon-grade uranium or highly enriched uranium components, they had both 80% and 90% enriched uranium. Well, you melt that down and turn it into an ingot, and then you give it back to the nuclear establishment. It's a tungsten tamper. They cut it up, and they reused that, but the they were high explosive propellants, let's say. They would burn up. They were self-destruct mechanisms distinctive to the nuclear weapon involving high explosives. They would then destroy that. And so they created decision trees on what do you destroy, what do you keep? And then so very specific instructions to the people dismantling the weapon of taking it apart and then taking the components. And I put this is in the South Africa book along with the description of each of these steps. But the point is it's been done. It's not that hard to do. The IA, when it came in to verify after the fact, it quibbled with the South Africans and said, well, but you kept this part, the ballistic tungsten tamper. And they said, no, that's proliferation sensitive, you've got to destroy it. So they took a harder line on what should be destroyed and what could be recycled. But nonetheless, you can take these things apart. And it took the South Africans about a week to dismantle each of their complete weapons. It was put in a front and back half, and it took a week for them to do the whole thing. So it wasn't even that time consuming. So let me end on that kind of positive note and turn it over to Houston.
My slides are not as detailed as what David had to say, I think, but I'm going to try to get across the reasons that we talk about this verification. First of all, we have some known cases where we have hard evidence the DPRK engaged in proliferation activities with Syria, Iran, Myanmar, AQ Khan in Libya, and selling nuclear dual-use items, such as nuclear-grade graphite. So these were some activities that we have evidence that have gone on in the past. So this initially makes you suspicious. How are we going to verify they're not going to do these kind of things in the future? So they've done things in the past. How's the future going to be different? So North Korea has a long history of subterfuge and proliferation, now proliferating to other countries and conducting illicit nuclear activities on their own. So not only have they worked to build up their nuclear facilities in their country, but they've helped other countries. How have they done this? Well, there's a number of ways. They've done the creation of procurement and sales entities that are able to manage smuggling networks. They've done this through using false descriptions and mislabeling of container contents. They've done this with falsification of manifests that are covering the shipments. And so they've also done alteration and facilitation and falsification of information concerning the original consigner and ultimate consignee. So all this information that goes out is modified, or there are a lot of ways to divert things. And so cargo has been diverted when shipments are underway. There could be multiple layers of intermediaries, so that everything gets clouded and obfuscated. There are shell companies, there are hidden payments, so lots of different ways to try to hide or obfuscate what's going on. So what we need from North Korea, if this is going to be successful, if we have some kind of agreement for North Korea to dismantle and verifiably dismantle the nuclear weapons program, we're going to have to have some changes in the way they do business. So we need to establish a statement that clearly defines what it is North Korea will not do and what they will do. In October 2007, the six-party agreement said that North Korea will not transfer nuclear materials, technology, or know-how. Well, that's a nice statement, but it's clearly insufficient to address all the things that need to be addressed. So this pause has to be replaced by something more likely to catch the range of all the things that need to be handled. The language has to clearly indicate what we mean. We have to say it clearly, precisely, and inclusively of all things that need to be addressed. So we don't have the final word on that. This is something that needs to be discussed and negotiated. But as opposed to just nuclear materials, technology, or know-how, we need to have something far more specific. For example, this is an example of a more effective statement. And if you can't read that in the back, it says North Korea agrees not to transfer to any state or entity whatsoever, or in any way help a state or entity to obtain nuclear weapons or explosive devices or components of such a system, nuclear material, nuclear know-how or technologies, equipment, material goods, or technology designed for, prepared for, or can contribute to the processing, use, or production of nuclear materials. So this may not be complete itself, but we have to put the emphasis here is that we have to spell out exactly what is expected. All parties have to agree to this and understand it. Have to define a commitment not to conduct illicit trade. So this is a critical part of any agreements that we might reach. So North Korea should not agree, should agree not to outfit facilities that would support and expand the nuclear program or conduct illicit trade and help other countries or entities. Now, verification approaches. Let me just digress for a moment. I'm going to give a simplistic view of what we're really talking about here. So a psychological experiment. Suppose you have a teenage kid. You loan them the family car for the night, They come back the next day and say, okay, did you have a good time? Oh, yeah, I had a great time. What did you do? You know, parents always ask more questions than their kids want to answer. So those of you who are not parents, you're kids, and so you understand both sides of this. Anyway, so then you go out the next morning, and you find an empty beer can in the car. Oh, so now you're saying trust has been violated. So you go and you get your kid, say, I found a beer can. Were you drinking? No, I wasn't drinking. Well, where did the beer can come from? Oh, it belongs to my friend. Oh, your friend. Your friend was drinking. Oh, no. So the friend comes over and said, oh, no, I found that empty beer can, and I was just taking it home to put it in the recycle. Okay, so now, what do you believe? What do you not believe? So the question is trust. How do you verify that the kid was not, had not been drinking, had not been driving? So you've got some suspicion now. So then how do you verify that all is there? So this is a tough question. So we know that we're starting out with North Korea, they got a case of beer in the back car, back of the car. So now we've got to figure out how do we go from where they are today to where we want them to be in the future as a productive part of society and not developing nuclear weapons or helping anyone else develop nuclear weapons. So verification, with all the things that David was talking about, commitment to openness and transparency and so forth, it's really all about trust. And so we have to develop a basis for trust. And those of you who have had people or instances where you've lost your trust, how do you regain it? It takes time. It's not something you do with signing one piece of paper happening overnight. So you have to work on that. So that's what the first bullet there means, is that verifying non-proliferation and non-trafficking is difficult to do and is virtually unexplored how you actually do this. So it's a real challenge. Verifying North Korean non-proliferation pledge will strengthen the effort to verify North Korea's declaration and dismantlement of its nuclear weapons program. So if we have a pledge in writing, agreement, a treaty, or whatever, then you have a basis to start looking at things and following up on that. So we have to identify what banned goods are. We have to work very hard, be very clear, very precise, that both sides, all sides, understand exactly what's going on. So, existing Security Council resolutions, the Sanctions Committee, and the UN Security Council panel of experts have identified goods that could be constituted into a list of goods that North Korea cannot transfer. So, that's a starting point. Some additions and perhaps exceptions for the civil directive is made modified on the list. So the verification organization task, we want to verify clauses in a new resolution covering a ban on proliferation. We want to evaluate reports from member states about continuing prohibition of exports. We will take on alleged violations. If a violation is alleged, we're going to study that. We're going to look into it with great robustness. We're going to determine on an ad hoc basis any additional materials, goods, or technologies that we want to add to the list. And we want to report the conclusions to the Security Council on a regular basis. So these are some activities that need to be involved in verification. The panel of experts should receive member state reports, conduct interviews, examine any seized goods that are flying, publish an annual report to assess North Korean compliance, submit reports to the verification committee and the Security Council. So these are active things that need to be pursued on a regular basis. All parties need to understand this. So, member states have a responsibility in making this work. So we have to monitor. The member states play a critical role in detecting noncompliance. So everybody has to be a part of this activity. detect suspected illicit trade by North Korea, and be proactive and timely in sharing sensitive information. So if you discover something, you have to let everybody know. So when you go to the airport, here it is, if you see something, say something. So that's sort of the whole tenet here. So North Korea should establish an export control agency. So we have an export control agency. North Korea is going to be involved in anything nuclear. They should have an export control agency of their own, domestically, looking at what's going on in the country, making sure that things don't go out of the country they're not supposed to, or come into the country they're not supposed to. They should be a part of this. It should not be the onus of everyone else. They have to be an active participant. Experts from the United States, China, and Russia, and maybe Japan and South Korea, would assist in developing an effective method to implement the legislation for North Korea. So we have export control agencies, so we can help them develop the legislation they would need in their country to have such an organization. So, my conclusion is that North Korea's commitment to nonproliferation will play an integral role in any verified dismantlement process. So it takes their participation, they're active and eager, working on making this happen. Any questions?
Do you want to grab? Houston said, any questions, comments? People sit down.
I'm Jim Finucane from Georgetown University. Have there been any real surprises in the last week or two in the developments regarding North Korea?
Yeah, I think I feel more hopeful. I mean, I think the news report about taking 5 nuclear weapons out of North Korea was a surprise. I have no idea what Chairman Kim will think about that, but I think it shows to me the administration is trying new approaches, seems to be getting well prepared to do these things, and have to hope that this will end well. So in that sense, I feel more encouraged than discouraged.
Hi, thanks. Andreas Ross with the German newspaper Frankfurt Allgemeine Zeitung. Without wanting to sound like Donald Rumsfeld when I talk about known unknowns and unknown unknowns, but if you compare the situation of what you think the United States government knows today about North Korea with what they knew in 2013 about Iran's nuclear program, could you give us an assessment of how that's different? I know that's not a knowable, but at least an assessment, and who other than the North Koreans could they ask to get some additional information?
What I've seen is there's a lot of cooperation with European countries, Germany, Britain, France. I mean, so collectively, they can have a much better picture of procurement by North Korea. I mean, obviously, the United States is kind of the elephant in the room, but there's a lot of other valuable contributions that help put together a more coherent picture of the in a sense, the nuclear infrastructure that certainly is unknown to the public. In terms of what was known, I mean, in 2013, it was a big issue. Was Iran building additional gas centrifuge plants underground? I mean, they said they would, and they actually announced that they'd started on one. And so part of the early part of the negotiations was to gain assurance from Iran that there was no such third gas centrifuge plant. And they knew quite a bit about the nuclear weapons effort. I mean, we'll see how much was unknown based on this Israeli grabbed archive. I mean, the Israelis claim there's a lot of new information in it that was not known by the United States or others before. and we'll see how significant it is. But I think on the North Korea case, I think it's tough to understand their centrifuge program, and it's certainly tough to understand the nuclear weaponization program. I mean, they are, one thing in one of the last statements of Kim, of the government who made it, but they talked about a cold place to do cold tests of nuclear weapons. They were talking about shutting down the nuclear test site and then saying, well, we also have a place to do cold tests. Which, for those of you who don't know, it's just you want to test the high explosive components of a nuclear weapon. You want to maybe take half of it, all assembled with a surrogate material in the middle, and blow it off and see how it works. You may take a whole one with a surrogate material in the middle, even with a neutron initiator, and see how it works. And so you typically do these at a special site. And South Africa had them. And I have pictures of those sites, or at least some of the sites in the book. So here's North Korea admitting to it. We have potential locations for those sites, but for us it's very hard to find. And I think even I would imagine for everybody it's hard to find those sites and to know that there's not another one someplace. So I think it's going to be a central challenge, and that's why in our work we structured it that North Korea has got to tell us what it's got. It can't be up to us to guess. And the other situation difference in Iran, which is critical, is that the IAEA did the heavy lifting of finding, and with the U.S. and allies, the heavy lifting of exposing the secret Iranian program in 2002 and 2003 and 2004. And that's when the really heavy lifting happened. And if you remember, the Iranians were lying like crazy and getting caught almost daily in another lie. And the IAEA was very aggressive, full support of the United States and other valuable allies. And so the program was exposed much more, and you had years of inspectors going in, uncovering other things, and none of that exists in North Korea. There's never been a thorough inspection of North Korea. I started doing that in 92, and it went so-so, and then sputtered out and hasn't been reconstituted since.
I think we have a feeling that we know more about Iran, perhaps, than we do, but we have had inspectors in there, we have people on the ground. In North Korea, we haven't had that for the last decade. There's been no real inspections, and it's a big country. So like David said, we expect them to tell us what they have, rather than going out and trying to find everything. It's going to be impossible. Needle in a haystack.
And I would expect Germany believes that, I don't know which part of Germany, I don't want to speak for the whole government, but I'm sure they believe there's another enrichment plan. And they would be surprised if there wasn't one revealed by North Korea. Maybe, we can all be wrong. I mean, it's hard work using the methods that we have. And defectors are often unreliable. So even when someone tells you something's there, it can be incorrect. In fact, we have reports from three defectors on sites we don't think are centrifuge points. We think the fourth one is true, but again, it may not be. You never know, but we think the other three were not. So people say the damnedest things.
Thank you, Chris Bidwell from the Federation of American Scientists. Thank you both for some great presentations. I wanted to talk a little bit more about declarations. It would seem that a declaration is going to be very necessary in this case if there is to be an agreement that's verifiable. What I'd like to get from you gentlemen is a little sense of what elements should be in what will be good enough in the declaration that it can be start to be verified, start the process of verifying against the declaration. What elements do you really think need to be in that declaration to make the system work?
There's a lot of things that happen, and some of this, it's best to rely on how the International Atomic Energy Agency does it, because they'll ask for a declaration of a country's nuclear program, and they worked out all kinds of protocols make sure that they get enough information that they can do a material balance and gain some assurance that there's not secret activities that haven't been declared. Here's some parts of it. And this again, just for uranium enrichment program, that you've got to have R&D facilities, component manufacturing places. I mean, you can just go through it, facilities to assemble, balance and test individual centrifuges, centrifuge plants.
So I think the philosophy is there are a lot of things that you know that a centrifuge plant or an enricher plant you have to have in order to get there, to go from nothing to having a plant. There are a lot of steps that you have to go through. You would expect to see where they did those things. And then if they're going to dismantle it, we have to see where they dismantled it and have a way of verifying that it was dismantled. So
yeah, and then here's another list. And this is, you have these slides now, so and I didn't even try to make it comprehensive. I mean, we have other things we've done where you can study. But this is where we think this should happen before you start, because you have to be fair to North Korea, too. I mean, and for example, we weren't fair to South Korea. The IAEA wasn't real fair to South Africa. It tried an approach using traditional safeguards methods to verify the highly enriched uranium inventory and failed. And then went back to them and said, now we need a whole bunch more information. And because they were cooperative, they went out and got it. But North Korea may not be as nice as South Africa. So you really do want to plan this from the beginning and figure out what you need.
If I can follow up for a second, David. You talked about the fissile material, HEU and plutonium. What about things like the missile program? Do we need declarations on those issues? We need declarations with regards to chemical and biological weapons, and who would be doing the verification of those issues?
Yeah, and I deliberately stayed away from that. I mean, one thing that evolved in the Iran discussions, mostly happening, I guess, in private, and it didn't pan out very well, but was the idea that an ICBM is equated to a nuclear weapons program, and therefore an ICBM program in North Korea would have to be part of the nuclear agreement if you used sort of the thinking that was applied in the efforts to fix the Iran deal. And so, but beyond that, I think the United States is going to have to work it out with North Korea. I mean, and with Japan, China. I mean, what amount of that missile program will be covered by these agreements? And I really wouldn't know. I mean, I know in the Iran case that, of course, the Europeans agreed to very strict limits or in this fix on ICBMs. That part of the deal was set. But they're personally worried about the intermediate-range ballistic missiles that can be fired by Iran. And so they, in the other part of the Iran negotiations, they certainly wanted to get a deal with the United States and Iran that would limit Iranian missiles to 2,000 kilometers, which was a statement Iran had made it's willing to live with. Well, that certainly didn't make the Israelis and the Saudi Arabians very happy. So there was also a commitment, well, maybe we'd have to ratchet down the range even further. But how do you do that? But I think that'll play out in North Korea. And I think it'll be what traffic will bear, where the U.S. will, I would imagine, start that it's absolutely necessary to dismantle the ICBM program.
Susan Cook, former bureaucrat. What about enforcement? I'm thinking of the experience of 1992 with North Korea's first declaration, which one could call laughable, and the IAEA response to require a special inspection. And the North Koreans, you know this history a whole lot better than I, just saying no, even though it was obligatory. What would be required in the new agreement to avoid the repeat of the past?
I would say don't take sanctions off very early.
that's a tough one for North Korea, but I mean, that's the leverage that can do better than was done on the Iran deal. I mean, think of an Iran deal in North Korea. What, are they going to reduce their nuclear weapons by two-thirds and then be able to build them back up after 10 years? I mean, you have to think through what you want and then keep the leverage in place. In terms of enforcement, I mean, you were very effective DOD bureaucrat. I'm sure you know how to interpret what President Trump has been saying about enforcement. I mean, he certainly made people nervous that he would attack North Korea. I don't know how serious he was in the end, but he certainly convinced many people that he was quite serious. And so I think North Korea will probably have that message reinforced. But in terms of things between sanctions and military threats, I'm not sure there are really many. I'm curious if others think there are. I mean, it's a problem of non-proliferation is that if you get away from export controls and commodity trafficking, there aren't a lot of laws that help you in any international enforcement action.
Thank you very much for this event. My name is Renata Jani. I work for TV Asahi, a Japanese TV station. So you talked earlier about the media reports of the possibility of sending missiles from North Korea to France to be dismantled. John Bolton in the Sunday shows yesterday brought up the possibility of nuclear weapons being sent to Tennessee instead of France to be dismantled. How would that change? Do you think North Korea would be amenable to Tennessee or off the table? Thank you.
I mean, that's really the big question, is how they're going to respond to this. I think we'll just have to wait. You know, the thing that people have to start thinking about, though, is that I outlined what would really be kind of a moderate centrist, if there was a scale a little bit to the right, of what verification should look like in North Korea. I mean, there's people I know that would have a much harsher command. Bolton would be one. There's people who have less. But I think we've gone through this quite a few times with North Korea, and all these deals have collapsed. So I think there is an expectation that they're going to have to do a lot more to convince us that they're sincere. And if they don't, then I think we want to know that right away. We don't want another process where everyone's energized to do something like after the North Korea tested in 2006. You do all this stuff, and then it's going great, and then it fades away, and North Korea just starts building nuclear weapons again. I think there is a desire, if it's not going to work, to know right away. If it doesn't work right away, then what do you then do? And I think I would expect there'll be hopefully an agreement with China, with our other allies in North Asia, with Russia, that sanctions would ramp up even more, and that Trump would probably make a lot more military threats. And so the whole situation could get pretty tense pretty quickly. But I think in the communities I live in, which straddles the center in a sense, I think there is a desire to get an answer quickly, not to, kick the can down the road or create a process that looks good initially and then just dies out and North Korea starts building weapons again. So I don't know. I don't know what the probability is. And I must confess, I have no interaction with the administration on this issue. I certainly had a lot of interactions on Iran nuclear, but I have no reading beyond what's in the press about what they intend to do. Yeah, there's a question.
Hi, Frank Om, U.S. Institute of Peace. Dave, you mentioned three steps to the denuclearization process. So hypothetically speaking, if North Korea was serious and committed to denuclearization, how quickly could we go through those three steps? Recognizing that there's a lot that we don't know.
We concocted a theoretical model this is part of the study. I didn't show the slide, but I just want to pull it up so I can remember it a little better. My memory is that on uranium enrichment, you could do everything. It's going to take years to gain confidence that there's no undeclared activity. It's kind of this idea of a broader conclusion under additional protocol. I mean, that just takes a long time. There's going to be, you can imagine, in South Africa, the IAEF were wrapped up in 2 years, but then they spent several more years fussing over a kilogram of weapon-grade uranium here, a kilogram there, and just trying to get it all sorted out down, you know, even further. But in the North Korea case, I think the initial thing has to be done, and we were estimating 30 months for enrichment. And I think weaponization can actually be done quicker if they're cooperative. I think enrichment is just the hardest to do. Plutonium, I think, can be done quicker. But here's this is based on these various, these are the phases that are defined up here. So I think it can be done in a reasonable amount of time. I mean, it's not instant. And I don't think, and even in Libya, I mean, what John Bolton, bless his heart, doesn't tell you, I mean, the U.S. effort was a tremendous success. And it took stuff out, and it was actually great. The IE took several years to try to get to the bottom of what Libya had done, and went back in and did the hard work of the verification, and learned all kinds of unpleasant surprises. People have given Libya, so much help on centrifuge, and there were all these networks. I mean, the U.S. was the lead on that effort, but still, the IE had to go back in and verify it in great detail. And that took a couple of years.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, Monsieur Sergio. Never mind, just, it seems we analyzed statements of White House since 14th of July of the previous year. Always President Macron was the key counterpart in talks regarding North Korea President and vice president. And now we see what is positive. The President Macron of France emerges as the foreign minister that is not in play. You mentioned that you don't have communication with the legislation, but no doubt that at least you have some feeling regarding that. That is positive. France in Libya, France in the Middle East, in Syria, France in the Far East, France in Iraq. Is that reality or illusion?
Where are you from?
Syria. Belgrade.
Oh, okay. I think the French intend to play an important role in what's going on with North Korea. I don't think they would see themselves at the table, but I think they see that they're within range of the ballistic missiles. They feel that they have something to contribute. So I think I don't know what discussions there's been between President Trump and Macron in North Korea. But I do know that when I heard a press report that the nuclear weapons could go to France, I found that credible based on my own discussions with the French. I mean, that they do want to play a productive role. Whether that's how it would play out, I don't know. I mean, John Bolton does want them at Oak Ridge. They may not be so welcoming of the plutonium-based weapons. I mean, it may be better to send those someplace else. It's more capable of handling plutonium, but I would encourage that the United States work beyond just the six parties, but bring in Europe and I do know on the procurement. I mean, the Germans and the Brits are pretty good at understanding procurement out of China, that maybe the Chinese don't even fully understand it. They're learning,
that have ended up with things ending up in North Korea.
Thank you.
Hi, Lucas Kuo from C4ADS. Dr. Albert, you had a slide in which you provided estimates of procurements related to centrifuge plants from 2002 and early 2016. And I was curious if you could explain your methodology how you arrived at these numbers, and also if you think this kind of macro level assessment is possible for other proliferation sensitive goods.
It's a sum total of the information we have on procurements, and what we do is we, I don't want to use the term cooperate with other governments, but share information with other governments. And if you look at the record, these amounts come up. In the early 2000, one of the indicators was outer casings for P2 centrifuges that matched the specifications exactly, or nearly exactly, of what Pakistan used for, they're called preforms of the outer casings. And then you can just count. And that's where, certainly where these 8 to 12,000 numbers come from. And then you look at the other procurements and then piece it together. Sometimes North Korea will buy for an entire cascade. You're looking at the Roots pumps, pressure transducers, various other equipment that goes into the centrifuge cascade. And so it's never 100% complete, but these values pop out as peaks in those procurements. Yeah, and I can answer more privately. I think it's a fairly detailed analysis that you have to do.
My name is Haruki Aikawa, from Japanese newspaper, my English course. I'd like to ask about North Korean centrifuges. North Korea has got P2 from P2 centrifuges. But Iran also has got P2 type of centrifuges through Dr. Epikan network. Iran couldn't master of the P2 centrifuges or couldn't get that rising steels with barrels. This why is also North Korea master?
I think North Korea was better at P2 because they had people sent to Pakistan to Khan Research Laboratories to assist on missiles in the 1990s. And according to Khan's confession and other declared information by the Pakistanis, North Korea got interested in the P2 centrifuge and were trained in making it. It turned out the missile work was being done in the P2 centrifuge workshop. Our assessment, I guess we have to check if it's an actual assessment or it's really just what was said in the confession. I think it was just said. They learned how to make P2. Now, Khan said he had nothing to do with it. These are sort of others that were being irresponsible. But they were, in a sense, trained by the masters at making these things. Iran never had that kind of training. And a P2 centrifuge rotor can be very complicated to make, to get it right. And Iran made a decision early to go with carbon fiber. And some of that probably had to do with they probably found it easier to acquire carbon fiber than Mirajin steel. They were able to get Mirajin steel, but they weren't able to make it. They could get it in the 90s, but I don't think they learned how to make it. We think maybe North Korea's learned how to make Mirajin steel. I mean, there's been procurements where they're buying the kind of the composite parts that you want. And they may have procured a lot of it back when it was pretty easy for them to procure via China, let alone earlier than that via Germany or Europe.
North Korea just got a better deal. They got P2s instead of P1s. They started with P2, Iran started with P1. Which was why they never went away from it earlier, I don't know.
Yeah, and one can argue, too, that it's a different mindset. And North Korea sort of just stuck to what they got. And Iran got more clever and veered off into carbon fiber. I mean, they developed something called a carbon fiber bellows, which from my understanding from IA people has been a complete failure. I mean, their advanced centrifuge program is really a bit in shambles. They went in many different directions. And so they had to overcome carbon fiber. They had all kinds of designs. The most advanced centrifuge, the IR-8, is just this big monster. They're very tall. You know, the way if you engineer that, it can't have the normal kind of centrifuge end cap on it. And it appears to have these carbon fiber bevels. And if you're familiar, carbon fiber is something that you use in cars and planes. And one of the advantages of it, it doesn't bend. But a bellows of a centrifuge, the whole point of it is so the rotor can bend. So how, you know, I know Urenco efforts in carbon fiber bellows were not, I think, were quickly dropped. So I don't know what Iran was thinking. But it, but I would say that there is this difference where North Korea tends to just kind of focus more on something simpler, and Iran has tried to go off in more, what would be called more advanced directions, but may have just been dead ends. Any other questions?
Mary Beth McKeegan from CRS. I was just wondering if you could help think through this idea of what they get to keep. So in the past, and in your experience in the Track 2s and the 2000s, I mean, they wanted to keep a power program, a nuclear power program. So do you think they will want that still, or was that just sort of part of the cover story from before? In other words, if they say, okay, well, we're going to go full speed ahead on weapons, transparency, dismantlement, plutonium program. We don't care about Yongbyon anymore, but we want our, you know, UEP for our light water reactors. How do you think the U.S. and others should respond at this time?
Yeah, I think certainly a UAP should just be not given at all. I mean, one can, and this is part of the fix idea, was, you know, what are we agreeing to in Iran in the end? I mean, it's fine to have this deal, like have it as long as possible, but in the end, Iran would rebuild its centrifuge program. It's uneconomical. I mean, it'll never make enriched uranium cheaper than what it could buy internationally. And one of the ideas in the fix that didn't go very far is, you know, is that in eight years from now, Iran, if it could demonstrate that it could make enriched uranium for less cost or equal cost to what it could pay for low enriched uranium internationally, then it's okay. If not, then it's a weapons program. It would just be, it's a simplistic view, but the idea is that if you can't make this LEU cheaper than what you can buy on the international market, then the enrichment program should not be tolerated. And in that sense, that this sort of, you'd have a snapback of sanctions. And I think that realization is that North Korea will never have an economical enrichment program, and that we should just commit to giving them all the enriched uranium we want. And I think that the question on the power reactors, research reactors, I have my own views, but I have no idea what Pompeo, Trump, Bolton think. I have no idea. I don't know if someone else has a better idea. I mean, John Bolton's been pretty strict. I mean, he was against Iran having the Bushehr reactor. And it's kind of based on Rice overload him on that. I mean, that history, by the way. So I think it's an issue that I think we'll just have to wait and see. I think North Korea is going to want basics. They want to make medical isotopes. They want to have electricity. And if they may argue for nuclear reactors. I would say that the twist there, though, is in the discussions I've had with the South Koreans, they're not real happy about how much money they spent on Kido. When I was there in 2011, they told me that the total price tag to that day was $10 billion, and there's no reactors. So, I mean, will South Korea step up again and commit billions of dollars to build a light water reactor? I'm not, when we finish this one, I'm not sure. I'll have to see. Or is it better to spend it on infrastructure in North Korea that would generate electricity? Maybe there's alternatives that make more sense. conservation, just moving into kind of more modern renewables that would make more sense in North Korea than big 1,000 megawatt electric reactors.
Yeah, I think we should limit, we should not allow them to have an original plan. That would be, my bargaining point, no original plan. And if they want to have an experimental reactor, it's got to be limited to the enrichment that U.S. Reactors offer. No more than that. So, and I think that has to be negotiated.
Mary Beth, what do you think? You've worked on this forever. I think you're going to have, you have a problem with people. When the South Africans decided to get rid of their program, not everybody liked that idea. And you're going to have North Korea, if they do this, they're going to have to manage people who are going to be mad about giving up the program itself. And the way, traditional way to channel that anger is channel it into civil nuclear power. And if you take that away too, then you're going to have to find some place for these people to work. Now again, it's a totalitarian society, so it's a problem that's easier than, let's say, in South Africa. But you're still going to have these other forces that are going to have to be reconciled with. And I saw some idea in the press sending, is there a report in the press about the United States has proposed sending out 10,000 nuclear? Is it really?
Well, send the North Korean export out of the country.
Send 10,000.
Yeah.
All right. Is that a?
I didn't see the number. I just seen that.
So they're yeah.
Where are they going to send them?
Serious.
Where are they going to send them to? Iran?
Well, that's what we have to avoid them doing.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. They could potentially be absorbed in the United States. I mean, I worked on one case with one family to bring in an ex who's head of the gas centrifuge program and bring him into the United States after the fall of Baghdad in 2003, and he had he had something to trade, and so it was doable. But I remember in the negotiations, and it was fine so long as it was only him, and then I said, yeah, but there's 9 members of that family, and it was holy hell to get those 9 people into this country. So if you take the, I don't know, thousands in the program and add in their families, you could easily be up around 50,000 to 60,000 people. So I don't know how you'd do it, but I mean, maybe it's worth doing with some, but I think it's going to be a challenge. I don't know who would decide to take them in. Maybe Angola. You know, there's no nuclear weapons program there to work on. There's no nuclear program to work on. So you would have they would be channeled into renewable energy and other things. So any other questions?
May I ask one more? And so could you please address a difference between dismantling and closing underground nuclear test sites?
Dismantle and closing. Well, I mean, you have to use dismantle in a very broad way. I mean, if you blow up the tunnels, take down all the buildings. There's a building near the tunnel entrance, which we can see is like a nuclear weapons, probably assembly, research, development facility. I mean, if that all disappears, then that's a good sign. I mean, that's dismantlement. I mean, what you don't have is it's not being done verifiably. And North Korea is acting as if this is going to be, at least in the press release they issued a couple of days ago, they're acting like, well, this is off limits now. I mean, that's a sign I picked up. I'm sure I'm wrong. But I think inspectors are going to need to go in there and verify that things are closed. But more importantly, I think they're going to have to go in there to drill back into the locations of the explosions and take samples. And it's what North Korea's done it itself. I mean, the 2012 test, there was some radioactive material detected in Japan, a very small amount, 2 months after the explosion. And that has to have been North Korea drilling back into the site and then some venting.
So I think it's, you know, you have, Londoners would have every reason to drill back in and get samples to see how well it worked. And verifiers would want to drill back in and just see how much plutonium and weapon-grade uranium or highly enriched uranium was used in the test. And the technology to do it is well-developed and not that complicated. And if North Korea allow that.
But back to the, what do you do with the thousands of workers in North Korea in nuclear fields? You know, at the end of the, when the Soviet Union failed, NATO stepped up. And there were a lot of grants available for scientists in the former Soviet Union who had been working in the nuclear field. There were grants available for them to do new things. I had about five guys from Russia who spent time at the university with me. And they got paid a per diem when they would come, and it was a regular grant. So they, you know, developed computational methods and other things that were non-nuclear. So they got involved, and, you know, you've got to have something for them to do. And so I think that outside governments and organizations could create opportunities for these people that could be work to the betterment of their society.
Yeah, and I should add, I mean, we have this wonderful entity called the Cooperative Threat Reduction Program in this country, and they can step in a major way. I mean, and they've learned a lot of how to avoid the pitfalls and the traps. So, I mean, they're a perfect organization to get involved in this very, very issue. And they're fully capable of moving into North Korea, setting up operations, just like Houston talked about, but doing it actually in North Korea. And I'm sure many countries would be willing to pay for it.
Kind of question, not comment. It seems that between the United States and North Korea, thanks God, there is that key word, trust, at the very beginning. The three Americans were free, finally. Because you know the faces when Mr. Popper used to go there 4 years ago, and faces of Mr. Pompeo and that is a very positive sign. And if trust is going to develop through the technique of everything in all directions, there is one thing which might be important, who will win Nobel Prize of Food Share. Fate of 13 Japanese at the Abdel Kings. That is something that President Trump promised to Mr. Abdel. And that is extraordinarily important for the trust.
Yeah. No, it's a good point. No, and the trust, yeah, I don't know how to, I mean, if they just had to get my trust, they'd have a lot easier time because I've known them, you know. But I will say, though, we've never known the military side well. And in some of the meetings I've been in with the foreign ministry, you know, when things are going bad and you sense that presence of the military, it's chilling. So I think, you know, if there is going to be trust, we have to figure out a way to involve them directly in this process and then make sure they bought into it. Because in the end, I mean, they could kill Kim Jong-un. I mean, who knows? I mean, who knows what could happen there? And so I think but I do share your sentiment. I think you have to feel optimistic and that they are open to considering the kinds of things I've been talking about today. Well, thank you very much. Happy to hang around for other questions. And
Yes, so if you've been on the list, then you got it anyway. Do you want to check on me? Because I'm sure you are. Also can send